more confident you will be when you use them in real life, and the more effective you will be as a communicator in English. And in this global world of ours, communicating effectively is absolutely key to success. By means of face-to-face classes or video conference classes, Vaughn will make all the difference for your English. And you will make all the difference for your company.
Más información en Barcelona en el 933398687. En Madrid en el 911335831.
Hi there, I'm Kyle Miller. If you want to improve your English, the worst thing you can do is leave it until next year. If you want to improve your English, the most obvious thing you can do is sign up for English class. If you want to sign up for English class, the most sensible thing you can do is sign up for English class with Vaughn. If you want to sign up for English class with Vaughn, the easiest thing you can do is sign up for 2 hours of class a week. But if you really want to improve your English, the best thing you can do is sign up for Vaughn Premium. 7.5 hours of class a week with the best English teachers in the business. That's the best thing about Vaughn Premium. Plus, a Daytown experience at the end of the course. And that's the coolest thing about Vaughn Premium. Vaughn Premium for people who are serious about improving their English.
Infórmate del curso intensivo Vaughan Premium en el 911335833.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and on tonight's program, I am going to be speaking first about one of the characters from Spanish history, one of the people I think is most strange, I don't know. This is going to be Sancho I de León, Sancho el Craso, the fat one. You are going to see all through his life that he was more or less a puppet. Little language lesson. I think I was talking about this on an earlier program. All of the times we use full and less, right? Careful, careless, useful, útil, useless. We have thoughtful, right? Un detallista. ¿Qué detalle? How thoughtful of you. And thoughtless, inconsciente. We have all of these fulls and less, but sometimes only full, sometimes beautiful, and sometimes only less. On my last program, I was talking about reckless. Reckless is temerario. There is no wreck, there is no wreckful, but we do have reckless, temerario. And history is filled with examples of reckless people. You have listless. I mentioned that on my last program. Listless. Listing is doing something purposeful, and listless is como inquieto, pero sin dirección. A listless person can't do anything but doesn't want to stay still either. And then we have Sancho I de León, who is a typical example of somebody who is feckless. F-E-C-K-L-E-S-S, feckless. Feckless is both irresponsible and useless. A person who really can't do anything right, and at the same time, you can't sympathize with him because he's just not a good person, not responsible, no character. This is a feckless person, and Sancho I de León, absolutely the key example of fecklessness. All right, his father had been a great warrior. His father was Ramiro II. And Ordoño III, his half-brother, took over for their father. Ordoño III was a great king. Now, poor Sancho, the son that was kind of an embarrassment, they just sent him out of the way. They sent him, he was in Castile. He was raised in Burgos and just, kind of relegated, not given the education he deserved, and supervised by his aunt, Sancha de Pamplona, his mother, of course, from Pamplona, and his grandmother, Toda. And she, of course, she is going to be instrumental in later on when he becomes king. But there was nobody at the beginning who thought he could amount to anything, that he could become anything, make anything of his life. Everybody sort of dismissed Sancho as being feckless, and, you know, I believe they were right. In any case, the Count of Castile, Fernán González, he rose up against the authority of León, but Ramiro and Ordoño captured him and took him to León. Now, Fernán González was, at this point, not in a position to negotiate. He was captive. He had committed treason. They could have killed him if they wanted to, but Fernán was liberated under three conditions. First, that he give up all of his property. He did that. Secondly, that he swear loyalty to Ordoño. And thirdly, that he marry his daughter, Urraca, to Ordoño. In other words, Fernán González is now the father-in-law of Ordoño and has an interest in the continuation of the Kingdom of León and some kind of connection between Castile and León. However, that really didn't stop him. I mean, later on, he rose up again. He rebelled against his son-in-law. And they decided that Sancho was going to be useful. They decided that Sancho was going to be better, perhaps, as an alternative to Ordoño. Sancho, at this point, is being kept sort of prisoner, semi-prisoner, in Burgos. By the way, Ordoño, who had been married to Urraca, to Fernán González's daughter, until this point, he repudiated her because he believed that she was an accomplice. She and her father were both trying to get him killed. The fact is that Ordoño finally did die, and it was time for Sancho to become king. And Sancho, who had not received a king's education, who had not been anything but depressed and lonely as a child, who had no social abilities, no emotional intelligence intellectual intelligence either. Sancho, who had been everybody's puppet until this point, once he was raised to becoming king, he was el hazme reír de todos. He was a laughingstock. And, The fact is that once Sancho was on the throne, it was going to be very, very easy for Fernán González to rise up again against León and finally make Castile independent. Now, Sancho really can't do anything. Really not capable of being king. Not a leader. Not the kind of person who gets on a horse and goes to war. Here he is, completely humiliated by Fernán González. And the daughter, Urraca, instead of marrying Sancho, Urraca marries Sancho's cousin, who is going to be, in the future, he's going to be Ordoño the IV. Sancho's capacity, even to have children, is put into question. Now, the thing is that he has eaten himself into obesity. Sancho is enormous. It's not for nothing they call him El Graso. He cannot lift a weapon. He cannot run. He can barely stand. He cannot ride on a horse. He cannot be a king. And so, in the end, with this whole conspiracy between Fernán González and his daughter Urraca to get the right person on the throne, well, they do it. They finally put Ordoño the IV on the throne, and Fernán González, again, is the father-in-law of the King of León. But Sancho is out. And he is lucky he was able to escape with his life. So where does he go? Back to his mother's territory, where his grandmother, Toda, is waiting for him. Toda has recently, let's see, she has been defeated, or rather the kingdom of Pamplona has been defeated, and she, as regent, she is under the vassalage of Cordoba, of Abderrahman III. She, in fact, is his great aunt. And there is a family connection there. But more importantly, it's a chance for Abderrahman III to put himself in the middle, to be the middleman, to be the intermediary in the politics of the Christian kingdoms in the north. So he sends his court physician, he sends his own personal physician, who also happens to be head of diplomacy, like, for example, the foreign affairs minister, a man named Hastai ibn Shaprut, who was one of the most knowledgeable doctors at that time, sends him up north to see what he can do about Sancho's condition. In the end, he says, there's nothing I can do here. You have to come back with me, all accompany me back to Cordoba. And they do. And it is, you can imagine, an enormous number of people going down there. Half the court of Pamplona going down, being welcomed in Cordoba, giving a king's welcome. In the chronicles of Cordoba, they tell about how magnificent that experience was. And so these are honored guests staying in the palace in Medina Zara. Toda, Sancho, and the king of Pamplona, García Sánchez I. Now, the way they get him to slim down, obviously, medical science has taken big steps since then, but the way they get him to slim down is violent and painful. They locked him in a room. Then they sewed up his mouth, right? Le cosieron la boca. So that he could only drink through a little part of his mouth and only liquids. And they gave him liquids. They gave him things that would make him, laxatives, things that would give him diarrhea, things that would provoke vomiting. They gave him constant baths so that he would sweat. And constant massages so that as his skin began to collapse, right, as his as the fat began to disappear, the skin would not be bolsas, right, like bags. You would have to reduce the las arrugas, no, the wrinkling that comes from a rapid reduction in body size. And so, during this process, which lasted for the better part of a year, almost a year, the only thing he had was liquid, and it consisted of salt water, basically salt water, but with azar, with orange blossoms. Remember that in English, a blossom is the word we use for flowers on a tree. And so, un cerezo en flor is a cherry tree, blossoms on a cherry tree. You have almond blossoms, you have orange blossoms, azar, agua de azar, orange blossom water. Now, this agua de azar evidently had miraculous properties because he was able to reduce in size. I mean, this regime did not kill him. Fruit and vegetable juices, lots of them, but no meat. Now, the fact is that all of this, going on for a very, very long time, brought him back down to a weight which was considered good for a king. And he, all of a sudden, he was able to ride. He was able to fight. He was able to do things that kings are supposed to do. But it was a very intensive process. And perhaps the only place in the world where this could have been done at that time was Cordoba. So, you have the comeback of Sancho I. Back in León, Ordoño IV is incredibly bad as a king and is highly unpopular. Nobody likes him. So, León is ready for a change. Now, in the year 959, so the fact is that he's been down there for, 2 years now. In the year 959, Sancho and an army from Córdoba, the army the Moors of Córdoba, of Abderrahman III, move north and retake León. Ordoño, of course, runs to Burgos, puts his wife and daughter and children in the hands of Fernán González, in the hands of his father-in-law, and then he goes to Cordoba so that he can argue his case to Abderrahman. The fact is, everybody knows who is in control. All of these major decisions are being made in Cordoba. At this point, all of the kingdoms in the north, all of the Christian kingdoms, they're simply como pawns, right? Piezas. All of them are pawns in the hands of Abderrahman. So, Ordoño is in Cordoba talking to Abderrahman. Abderrahman decides to keep him there as prisoner. Decides that he's going to see what Sancho does on the throne. He ends up that Sancho gets married, has two children. Gonzalo Fernandez, the new king, or rather the new the head of Castile, Gonzalo Fernandez, Fernan Gonzalez's son, Gonzalo Fernandez in Castile, does what his father did so well, tries to rebel, tries to break free of León. He is defeated. And as a sign of his submission, as a sign of peace, he gives Sancho an apple. Sancho starts eating that apple, but the apple kills him. So historians really don't, you know, historians are debating what that apple was about, what happened with that apple. But, and what would have happened if Sancho had lived, if he had been able to continue, what kind of king he would have made. Now, it's time to move on a little bit in history and talk about what happened after Abderrahman was no longer in power, after he died. Remember that Al-Hakam, his son, inherited when his father, he inherited when he was 46 years old. And I told this story on this program before. He was happily married to his wife, Aurora, called Sub, a Basque, who had originally entered into the harem as a slave. And he had children. He was very much a family man. He loved books, but did not pay too much attention to the military campaigns. He did take over from his father as caliph, as the prince of believers. And he took it very seriously, very much isolated from his people, very much a believer in barriers between the royalty, between the nobles, between the caliph and the common people. Every time the people were able to see him, which was not often, this was all in staged events. He was a great believer in protocol. Now, many of the people he promoted, and many of the people, Sub, his wife, working behind the scenes, trying to establish absolute loyalty to herself and her family. And many of these new people were Slavs, Slavic. Many of these were slaves imported, mercenaries. Many of them achieved positions of great power in Cordoba. And prosperity, especially agricultural prosperity, with all of these innovations, all these technological innovations, finally, this is all beginning to bear fruit. Countryside comes to life, and there is a great deal of prosperity, but all good things must come to an end. Al-Hakam dies in the year 976. Al-Manthor, at that point, his cleverest follower, somebody who's risen in power astronomically over the last couple of years. Al-Manthor at this point is 38 years old. Now, Al-Manthor, it's very difficult to think of how to characterize him, how to qualify him. Al-Manthor, like a fox in the hen house. That's one metaphor we use. A snake in the grass. In English, we use both metaphors quite often. A fox in the hen house. A snake in the grass. Or a wolf in sheep's clothing. Because he's going to do everything for the caliphate. But in reality, it seems like the caliphate means nothing to him. He's doing it all for himself. It's his personal ambition that is coming out. Now, Al-Manthor, born to a prestigious family, they say that ancestors of his were there when Tariq first crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, so that they were there from the beginning. But a Yemeni family. All right, I have to take a short break now. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the second part of the program.
Hi there, this is Richard Brown. If you are really serious about improving your English, 2 hours of English class a week is not enough. If you're really serious about improving your verbal agility, 2 hours of English class a week is not enough. If you're really serious about getting rid of all those typical mistakes you've been making your whole life, 2 hours of English class a week is simply not enough. If you're really serious about consolidating your vocabulary, 2 hours of English class a week is not enough. If you're really serious about sounding more natural in how you join words together, 2 hours of English class a week is not enough. If you're really serious about mastering those essential grammatical structures you still make mistakes on, 2 hours of English class a week is definitely not enough. If you're really serious about expressing yourself with confidence, 2 hours of English class a week is not enough. If you are really serious about improving your English, Baugen Premium is for you. 7.5 hours of class a week with the best English teachers in the business. Plus, a daytown experience at the end of the 12 to 13 week course, exposing you to a wide variety of accents from around the English-speaking world. Baugen Premium, for people who are serious about improving their English.
Infórmate del curso intensivo Baugen Premium en el 911335833.
¿Y a ti? ¿Se te hace cuesta arriba el inglés? Clases 100% método Vaughan para todos los niveles que te darán el empujón que necesitas para vencer todas tus dificultades con el idioma. Más información en el 911335833 o en grupovaughan.com.
Tres meses y luego, ¡pum!, ya está.
Este año no hay excusas. Apúntate ahora llamando al 91-133-5833 o entra en grupobaugan.com.
¿Y tú qué has hecho en los tres últimos meses? Si no has hecho nada por tu inglés, ahora es el momento. Apúntate a nuestros cursos trimestrales 100% método Vaughan, clases 100% orales en grupos reducidos. La matrícula ya está abierta para todos los niveles, así que no pierdas ni un segundo más e infórmate en Barcelona en el 933398687, en Madrid 91-133-5833.
A ver, Riviera Maya, hotel con pulserita.
¿Y los niños qué? No dejes las cosas para el último momento. Reserva ya el campamento de verano en inglés para tus hijos. Si quieres regalarles un verano increíble en inglés, resérvales un campamento de verano Vaughan. Infórmate ya en el 91-133-5832 o en grupobaughan.com.
Después de nuestros summer camps, no querrán volver a casa. Apúntalos a uno de nuestros campamentos de verano en inglés, sin clases. Este verano, regálales una experiencia inolvidable en inglés con sus amigos. Regálales un summer camp. Más información en el 91-133-5832 o en grupobaugan.com.
Aprende, diviértete. Esto, lo que escuchas, es Vaughan Radio. Los cursos trimestrales de Vaughan son ideales para gente que necesita resultados a medio plazo y a un precio asequible. Descúbrelos en grupobaughan.com. Los cursos trimestrales te ofrecen este programa.
Welcome back. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on the first part of the program, I was speaking about Sancho el Graso. I was speaking about one of the characters from Spanish history that I find very interesting, very curious, very sad in a way. And now another personage, another character from Spanish history who, there was a turning point. There was a before and after. I'm talking about Almanzor. Now, I mentioned that he is often called the el zorro en el gallinero. That's what we call him. The fox in the hen house. Because he was able to do everything in such a way that it benefited himself much more than it did Córdoba. This is pan para hoy, hambre para mañana, right? This is a short-term solution, short-termism. The fact is that, well, I was talking about his birth and his early age. He was from a lineage, relatively famous lineage, but from Yemen, which meant that he was not a Quraysh. He was not from the, he did not have the blood of the Prophet Muhammad running through his veins. Yes, he, there was no way he was going to eclipse the power of a legitimate caliph. And no way he could take control. He would always have to exercise his control behind the scenes. But he was okay with that. That, in fact, was what he did. He almost immediately, with the help of Sub, with the help of the wife of Al-Hakam, he became the master of the estates of the heir of Hisham II. When he was only 27, he was able to do that. By the way, he was, as I say, he was born and raised in Algeciras. And then his parents were relatively prosperous. He was able to go to Córdoba at an early age and study. They gave him the best education money can buy in Córdoba, and there his talents were recognized almost immediately, and he ascended, in part because of his own ambition, but in part because of talent, and because of his friendship with the queen, with Sub, he was able to ascend. And so at age 27, here he is, master of the property, master of the estates, master of the patrimonio of the heir, Hisham II. Then he became the tutor of Hisham II. Now, many reasons why Hisham II was never going to be a real leader, a real caliph. Some say that it is the result of a disease that he had as a child. When he was a child, evidently he suffered from viruela, from smallpox, and that this had a terrible impact on both his body and his mind. He never recovered. Other people say that he was simply weak, and he had a weak body, a weak mind. It was the way he was born. Other people say that Almanzor did everything he could to make the boy even weaker, that he gave the boy any kind of pleasure he wanted, and kept him isolated there, a little like what happened to Fernando VII Napoleon simply took over, put his brother on the Spanish throne, and then took the king, the Bourbon king, off into a palace and gave him all the alcohol and all the women he wanted, and just kept him there year after year, deluded with pleasure. Well, that is, that's one of the possibilities here with Hisham II. We don't know what Almanzor did, but yes, he took over completely. The whole thing was a charade. The only person who had power there was Almanzor. By the way, Sub gets very worried. We know that in the end, she believed that Almanzor was a threat to her, but she disappears from the pages of history. We don't know what happened to her. One of the possible rivals, one of the possible obstacles to power at this point would have been Al-Hakam's brother. Al-Hakam's brother was found murdered. Don't know who did it. The Romans would have asked, qui bono, the Romans would have asked, who benefits from this murder, from this killing? Almanzor, obviously. But those kind of questions, maybe people were afraid to ask them by that point. Now, a second possible obstacle would have been the hijab, the vizier, the balido, al-Mushafi, named regent but co-regent with Almanzor. Almanzor almost immediately decides that his future and the source of his popularity will have to be military. The first thing he does is to go on a campaign, a military campaign in Galicia. And they get a lot of money. The Christians aren't expecting this. At this point, all of the Christian kingdoms are paying protection money. They're paying lots of protection money so that this kind of thing will not happen. And here, Almanzor goes up and attacks them anyway. All right. In this Galicia campaign, yes, there is a lot of el botín de guerra, right? The spoils of war, the booty, is copious. It's abundant. And he is very generous, which means he has the undivided loyalty of his troops. Now, he comes back a war hero and immediately accuses al-Mushafi, who hasn't been anywhere, who's been in Cordoba, he immediately accuses al-Mushafi of malversación, right? Misappropriation of public funds. Embezzlement, we call it. And al-Mushafi, of course, he was guilty. I mean, al-Mansur had his spies everywhere. Al-Mushafi was sent to prison, and you know what happened in prison. You can imagine what happened in prison. Al-Mushafi was found dead, killed in prison. All right, so the only two people that stood in the way, the only two obstacles to power for al-Mansur had been murdered. He made sure, al-Mansur made sure that nobody saw the caliph. Nobody saw the boy caliph. The boy caliph, at this time, incapable of presiding, incapable of being in a public function, incapable of speaking in public, leading, organizing. No. Now, One of the things that al-Hakam, you know, the ex-caliph, the ex-leader, the son of Abdurrahman III, one of the things that al-Hakam had been famous for was his library. He had the biggest library, maybe the biggest library in the world at that time. Some people say 400,000 volumes. Some people say more. But it was an absolutely incredible library. And many of the books in it were irreplaceable. Well, somewhere it got burnt. And different historians attribute different hands for that burning. Remember that all of Cordoba is going to be burnt very, very quickly. That what al-Mansur is doing now is going to degenerate into a civil war very, very quickly. That al-Mansur's sons are not going to be able to hold on to power. And very soon, there are going to be all kinds of different groups coming in, burning everything they see, and that one of the victims of this violence will be the library and its irreplaceable volumes. Well, the fact is that al-Mansur is also a possible culprit, right? Un culpable, a culprit, because al-Mansur burnt all of the books that he thought might offend the sensibilities of the strictest of the imams of the religious authorities there, the al-faqirs. And he was very, very, very much in favor of burning books. Now, some say that he burned down the entire library. Other people say that that came later. But it does indicate the kind of person he was. Book burning was nothing to him. Now, one of the great things he also did was, you remember I said, at the beginning, I was talking about the fact that Sub and the earlier family there, they had filled the palace with people from Central Europe, slaves from Central Europe. And these slaves from Central Europe, all through the army, all through the administration, all through the harem, these people, they were very important, very influential. And Almanzor decided that he couldn't trust them, that they had to go. He expelled them. He deprived them of power. That was the end of Slavic influence. We're going to see them come back in the Reinas de Taifas, but in the future, the only power will be held by Berbers. And remember that traditionally the Arabs, they miraron por encima del hombro, right? They looked down on, that's in English, look down on, mirar con desprecio, despreciar, mirar por encima del hombro, to look down on. The Arabs looked down on the Berbers, these people from North Africa, who were not Arab, their culture was not Arab, and yet here they were. There had been Berbers since the beginning, since the first invasion in 711. They were usually given the poorest land. They were usually, instead of irrigation farming, they practiced secano, right, dry farming, or pastoreo, or grazing. But recently there had been all kinds of movements in North Africa among the Berbers, loyalties and pacts and invasions and military moves, and there were several formidable clans, because the entire organization in North Africa, the entire organization of the Berbers was on the level of tribe and clan. And Almanzor used this to his advantage and brought many, many mercenaries across the Straits of Gibraltar to serve in his army with unquestioning loyalty to him, and only to him, exclusively to Almanzor. They didn't care about Cordoba. They didn't care about Spain. They didn't care about where they were or what they did. It's just somebody tells them to attack, destroy, kill, whatever. They do it. And they accept the money afterwards. Pure mercenaries. So, one of the big obstacles getting in the way his name was Galib. He was a Slav, and the fact is that they had fought together before. They had been on the same side, Galib and Almanzor, but Galib was, again, he was an old man. He commanded a lot of respect, a lot of authority. But he did not, he was not loyal to Almanzor, and did not believe in what Almanzor was doing. The fact is that there was a battle in Torrevicente, in Atienza, and the Berbers were there. The Berber armies were there. Galib was, he believed in peace with the northern kingdoms, and so he had several Christian allies there with him. He was, if anybody believed in this concept of convivencia, it was Galib. He was there with García Fernández, the Count of Castile. He was with there. He was there with Ramiro Garcés. He was there. Well, he was an ally of the Christian kingdoms, but of course the Berbers didn't care. Initially, Ghalib led the charge. He was 80 years old, but he led the initial charge, and the Berbers ran away. But then something strange happened. Ghalib invoked divine providence. He kept talking about, you know, talking about Allah, may Allah decide who is the victor today. Right? And mentioning this again and again, making sure that everybody understood that whoever won, it would be divine choice. It would be a sign from God. And at this point, he disappeared. Ghalib simply disappeared. He got on his horse and he went away. And everybody thought that he was answering the call of nature, that he was using this time to relieve himself, to take a piss. But then he didn't come back. He didn't come back. And people got worried. It was called the Alianza de las Tres Naciones. And they were all there representing the side of peace. Peace versus jihad. Peace versus holy war. Because that's how Almanzor had thought of it. That's how he had convinced the Berber tribes to cross and fight. Well, after a while, they went to look for Ghalib and found him dead on the ground, presumably untouched. Some historians say that, yes, he must have fallen from his horse. Other historians say this, that, or the other. But the fact is, he was dead with no sign of violence. And it's difficult not to think of this as a sign of divine intervention. Many of the people on his side were very, very disappointed by this. And without Ghalib as a unifying spirit, well, this was going to be a disaster. In any case, almost immediately, people went to Almanzor, telling them what had happened. It wasn't until they cut off Ghalib's hand and gave that hand to Almanzor that he was able to believe it himself, that he was that he was convinced that he had won this battle. Yeah. By the way, he had Ghalib taken to Cordoba. He had his skin, como desecado, right? That he filled with cotton. So stuffed, we would say, relleno, with algodón, with cotton, and crucified in Córdoba. The head, Ghalib's head, placed on a cross at Medina Zara, where it stayed there until Medina Zara was destroyed. Because, as I say, this can't go on. A few years from now, Medina Zara, well, all of Córdoba, is going to be destroyed. The fact is that, he was able to take advantage of this to move from Atienza up north into Calatayud, and he was very, very victorious after this, and the whole thing. This began an entire series of raids. Athafas, to the north. An entire series of, some people say 56, others 58, others 60. But in each and every one of them, each and every one of them, Almanthor was victorious. His name means the victorious one. And all of these places, Coimbra, Zamora, Sahagún, the great monastery of Sahagún, one of the largest, one of the most one of the most amazing places in medieval Spain, completely destroyed. Saldaña, Carrión de los Condes, things. He was just completely destroying everything he could. Both in the north and in the south, because at this point, you know, with all of his with all of his Berber allies, he also has to play that same game in North Africa. For the next couple of hundred years, we're going to see that anything that happens in North Africa is going to have a reflection in Spain. So yes, his troops take over Fez in what is today Morocco. All of this time, he is playing the religion card. He is telling people that this is a holy war. And, well, this is going to, it will have an echo. It will have an echo very soon in Christianity. Pope Alexander II is going to tell people that Christians living with Muslims is unacceptable. It's unchristian. It is a sin, un pecado. And, well, things begin to degenerate from this point. I've run out of time. I'm going to continue on my program tomorrow. Bye-bye.
¿Sabes? Me da la sensación que estás pensando, bueno, esto ya después de las vacaciones me pondré con ello. ¿En serio? ¿Das por perdido ya este curso? ¿Lo dejas para septiembre? ¿En serio? ¿Aún estás a tiempo? Llama e infórmate sobre los cursos intensivos en grupos reducidos. Sí, sí, porque puedes venir con un amigo, con un familiar. Cursos intensivos en grupos reducidos. Infórmate en el teléfono del inglés 91-133-5833. 91-133-5833.